Next case of the day is number 063501, Beverly Stevenson against Higher Electric Company. Ms. Kilroy.
Kinoy,
I'm sorry.
May it please the court. My name is Joanne Kinoy. I represent Beverly Stevenson, the appellant. Ms. Stevenson worked as a clerical for Higher Electric for 8 years without incident, discipline, or absenteeism. On February 9th, 2004, she became ill and missed 2 weeks of work. When she tried to return to her employment, she found she was locked out of the workplace and terminated. This case, reduced to its core, involves two issues. Did Higher have initial notice that Stevenson might need an FMLA qualifying leave? And second, did she have a serious medical condition as that's defined under the Act? We know from the record that Higher had initial notice because on February 11th, Higher told Stevenson in writing that since she had been out of work since the 9th due to what they called her claimed illness and she didn't have any additional available leave, she would have to provide a medical certification for what they call a serious health condition FMLA leave. The letter further indicated that if she didn't provide the certification by February 24th, that's 6 days later, she'd be terminated.
Now, I'm a little bit concerned with, in a sense, punishing Higher for thinking about FMLA. I mean, I don't know that we want to go so far as to say that employers who utter those words in some context have somehow conceded that all of the requirements, which are statutory in nature, of FMLA apply.
I don't think we're going that far, Your Honor. But if that had been the case, that it was truly advisory, which is what Higher's position is, the letter, then when my client returned to work the following Monday, she should have been able to go back to work. The point is...
As you know, there are these subtle lines in the FMLA between, if you will, just illness or some reason to be away from work that might be covered by a sick leave policy and the kind of serious illness that triggers... It was a line Congress decided to draw in the statute. And I guess I'm just worried about saying that there's actual notice based on the comment in this letter. Now, maybe there's constructive notice. Obviously, her behavior, as you've argued, changes dramatically. There's no record that she was ever screaming at people and so on beforehand. But I'm worried about that particular basis of actual notice.
Well, let me talk specifically to the kind of notice that we believe that she did give and why that we believe that qualifies under the standard, which is fairly low, of an initial notice of an FMLA qualifying leave. She gave her initial notice in several ways. One, she gave direct notice. She called in. She provided medical records from her emergency room visit. She provided copies of her prescriptions and two doctor's notes. And these were all before the time period of the 24th when she was required to produce a so-called certification.
Now, when you say she provided the ER records and so on, are these the things that she supposedly put on the desk of this guy who was on, or the person, the accounting person?
Yes, this is what she brought in on the 17th.
Okay.
And it was copies of the prescriptions. And then within the next couple of days, she provided two notes from her attending doctor, Dr. Lizik. And in addition, as you've already indicated, we believe that Higher had constructive notice of her illness by observing her dramatically changed personal interactions and behavior on three occasions during this two-week period. Under this circuit's holdings in Byrne and later clarified in Burnett, these facts, when considered together and in context, establish sufficient initial notice. And the inquiry as to the sufficiency of this initial notice must include consideration that Higher Electric, by choice, provided absolutely no guidance, no forms to help an employee comply with the FMLA. Stevenson, my client, had never been given or seen an employee manual. She was never given FMLA forms or instructions, nor she had never even heard of the FMLA before this incident. And despite this lack of guidance and information, Stevenson did everything she thought she had to do to save her job. She called in each day, she obtained the treatment, she provided whatever medical records she had, two notes from her doctors, and she returned to the company ready to work on the 24th. Now, on the second issue that's before the court, We believe that the evidentiary record is more than sufficient to establish that Stevenson suffered from an FMLA serious medical health condition as a matter of law. The record contains medical records from the emergency room, not just the discharge summary that she had given to her employer, but the emergency records. They include the medical records from the two subsequent visits to her doctor, as well as prior clinical records. The record also, and most importantly, contains Dr. Lizik's deposition testimony. Dr. Lizik is board certified in both pediatrics and internal medicine. She'd been treating my client for 3 or 4 years before this incident. She testified that she was familiar with the FMLA and that Stevenson had a serious medical condition that prevented her from working during that 2-week period. Dr. Lizik explained in detail during her deposition that Stevenson's existing medical conditions combined with the acute anxiety episode at work caused her symptoms, which included persistent insomnia, anxiety, headaches, and palpitations, which prevented her from engaging in 8-hour work during that 2-week period. When Dr. Lizik treated Ms. Stevenson, she prescribed increased medication for her hypertension and her anemia, and additionally prescribed Elavil to help resolve her anxiety and her insomnia. After Ms. Stevenson's acute symptoms resolved, Dr. Lizik released her to return to work. We believe that Ms. Stevenson is also entitled to entry of judgment on her cross motion for summary judgment, which was denied by the district court. She is entitled to judgment based on several violations of the FMLA regulatory scheme, the most blatant being that the regulations state without ambiguity that an employer must allow a minimum of 15 days in which to provide the requested medical certification. Hire requested the certification for the first time and the only time in a letter dated February 17th, received by Stevenson by overnight delivery on February 18th, mandating compliance 6 days later or by February 24th.
Now, your opponent, of course, argues that she wasn't somehow really fired until March 4th or so.
March 9th, right.
March 9th, yeah. So what's the evidence, you know, again, we're on summary judgment, so what would the evidence on the other side of that proposition be?
We know that that's not true, because if you look at the termination letter, which we've quoted at length in our reply brief, mm-hmm. The termination letter says not only were the doctor's notes that you submitted not sufficient as an FMLA certification, but because they were submitted on February 25th, they were too late. Now, if a notice that was given on February 25th is too late, we are entitled to the inference that anything else that was potentially submitted between the 25th and the day they got around to filing the termination letter would have also been considered too late. And we think that that hire's position that as to that issue that they've taken during the litigation just doesn't hold up by their own documents. I think I'll hold on to a little bit of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kanoy. We'll hear now from Mr. Gingold. Mr. Gingold, if you'd like to raise the podium, there's a button on the right-hand side. Perhaps you could help the help counsel. You got it. Good.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Scott Gingold, and I represent the Appellee Hire Electric Company. There are a few points that I would like to make today, but first I'd like to correct a couple of inaccuracies raised by my opposing counsel. I'd like to remind the court that while it is required to make reasonable inferences from the facts of record, as the court has stated, including in the Halfling case cited in our brief, it's under no obligation to draw inferences from assumptions that are unsupported by the record, and that's exactly what Ms. Stevenson and her counsel are asking the court to do. There are actually three independent issues, not two, that the district court ruled on, each of which by itself, if affirmed by this court, would require the termination of this case. Of course, there's whether or not there was initial notice provided and whether or not Ms. Stevenson has demonstrated that she suffered from a serious health condition, but there's also the timeliness of the notice, and that's an independent basis for this court to affirm the district court's decision.
But, you know, I have to say, Mr. Gingold, we are on summary judgment, and this court's decisions, especially when there's a mental disorder, have shown some flexibility in the timing requirement you mentioned, and it strikes me that the set of facts here on the constructive notice idea, as I said, I have some issue with the letter, but on the constructive notice idea, strike me as quite similar to those we discussed in Byrne against Avon Products. Now, no case is ever a complete, you know, replica of another case, but this was a person who was working quite satisfactorily along. Suddenly, you know, there is evidence in the record, which, if believed by a trier of fact, shows she's screaming. She's, you know, she can't stay there all day. She's using profanities. She's agitated. The union people are even afraid that she's going to do something violent. I mean, this is a remarkably changed individual, and that's the kind of record on which constructive notice was found. Now, I certainly can imagine a contest of fact on that, but if there's a contested issue of material fact on constructive notice, we would have to resolve that in her favor at this point.
I think that this case, if this case fell under the Byrne exception, it would be taking this court's notion of constructive notice a bit too far.
Why is that, given that all of these cases are fact-specific, and as I said, you can look in the light most favorable to her at her behavior and what she was doing and the testimony of these various people, and this is a person with a wildly changed behavior pattern.
Well, I don't agree that her behavior pattern was wildly changed, Your Honor.
But you wrote puppy in your brief, too. I mean, that really, I don't think that's taking the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff.
Well, the testimony of the record was that it was a puppy. Miss Stevenson didn't have any speculation how old the dog was. We weren't mischaracterizing the record.
It was a dog.
I mean,
it was a dog that came, you know, as she perceived it, came charging up to her, puppy or otherwise. I mean, I can think of some dogs when in their puppy stage, you know, who would be very intimidating, but
Miss Stevenson's perception is what it is, of course, Your Honor, of what the dog, and her reaction was what it was. However, getting to the constructive notice point, as this court distinguished in Burnett, in which it found that there was no the constructive notice exception to the FMLA requirements of actual notice didn't apply in that case.
But again, Burnett, I mean,
sorry.
What we have to decide, yes, Burnett came out the other way, but it was a different sort of situation there.
Well, it was the situation in Burnett was more similar to this case than it was in Byrne. In Byrne, the employee began sleeping in a storage room on the job, and one of the coworkers reported it to the company, and the company was concerned enough about it that it installed a security camera and began to investigate the behavior to see if something was wrong. And the court held in Byrne that the employee's drastic change in behavior may have been indication to the employer that something had gone medically wrong with the employee.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. You know, again, taking the facts most favorably to her, and I really don't know how any of this would sort out after a trial, she had a very similar drastic change. Nobody was talking about locking her out because she's dangerous to people before this incident. That's a big step to take. Just like installing cameras, arguably it's a bigger step than cameras.
Well, the difference is that locking someone out in this case wasn't an investigative measure to see if there was something wrong with someone. In this case, the testimony is that Ms. Stevenson's behavior indicated that Heyer believed she was angry. And if it's the case that any time an employee becomes angry and yells at supervisors, even if it's an employee who doesn't typically do that, gets angry or yells at coworkers, starts skipping work, it can't be that constitutes notice under the FMLA because that would effectively eviscerate the actual notice requirement.
No, I mean, if you phrase it that way, of course, but this is more than just getting angry. It's angry in a context where there are emergency room records being tendered, there are doctor's visits. Higher at one point says, oh, she's a pediatrician. Why should we pay attention to her?
Well, the emergency room records that were tendered to Higher just said that she had been to the emergency room and that she was sent out with a diagnosis of anxiety. They were tendered to Higher on a day that she came to work feeling, by her own testimony, well enough to work.
And then she doesn't last, though, through the day. And I guess that already distinguishes it. Anger plus ER diagnosis of anxiety isn't just every employee who loses his temper.
Well, she went to the emergency room, and she was discharged in stable condition, which her doctor has testified means stable to continue living and functioning. So at the time she left the emergency room on February 11th, she was, by her own doctor's testimony, stable to continue living and functioning. And that gets to another point, which is the district court's holding that Ms. Stevenson has not proved that she suffered from a serious health condition. Now, whether or not her condition was a serious health condition is certainly not our point.
How can we come to that conclusion without ignoring Dr. Lissick's testimony?
Dr. Lissick didn't testify that Beverly Stevenson suffered from a serious health condition as defined by the FMLA.
Well, but she said, I don't have the forms. She said, no, but I understood her to be talking about the forms in that excerpt.
Dr. Lissick has never testified that Ms. Stevenson was unable to work during the time period in question or unable to perform other daily activities, which is the statutory standard for what it means to not to fall within the serious health condition definition. Dr. Lissick couldn't do so because she was uninformed as to what the functions of Ms. Stevenson's job were. She had no idea that Ms. Stevenson had missed any work at all by the time she saw her 9 days after she started missing work, and is unequipped to make any kind of statement that she suffered from a serious health condition in any way other than a conclusory one, which is not admissible at this stage. As this court has said many times, this is summary judgment. It's put up or shut up time, and Ms. Stevenson didn't submit any statement from her doctor that she suffered from a serious health condition under the FMLA. I just wanted to get back to the initial point, which was the timeliness of the notice, Your Honors. Regardless of whether she had a serious health condition and regardless of whether or not Higher had actual notice at some point that the FMLA may apply, neither of which we agree is the case, Ms. Stevenson was still obligated to provide timely notice of her absences, not only timely notice that she was going to miss work, but also of when she expected to return. Now, Ms. Stevenson didn't raise this issue at all in her initial brief, and in her reply brief stated only that the record supports that she had no prior warning and didn't know how long she would be out. However, the facts of the case show otherwise. She made herself a doctor appointment on February 13th or 14th, knowing she'd be out on February 18th. And despite daily calls to Higher Electric Company, and despite coming in on February 17th, didn't tell anybody that she would be out on the 18th. She claims that Dr. Lissick instructed her not to work when she saw her on February 18th, instructed her to stay out for the rest of the week. We don't agree that that took place because the medical records don't support that, and Dr. Lissick has no memory of making that instruction. So
why isn't her testimony competent on that? She was party to that conversation.
It's hearsay.
No, she says this is what I was told.
She says Dr. Lissick told me not to work, right?
Well, yeah, but she was party to that conversation.
Dr. Lissick's testimony is, my records don't show that.
She doesn't contradict it.
I would have written it down, and I don't remember giving that instruction.
Okay.
May I just finish the last point on that? She claims that Dr. Lissick had instructed her not to work for the rest of the week, and yet she didn't tell Higher that she wasn't going to be in the rest of the week, despite, again, her daily calls. Thank you, Your Honors, if you don't have any other questions.
Thank you, Counsel. How much time does Ms. Kanoy have? Thank you. 2 minutes, Ms. Kanoy.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have two brief comments. Under the constructive notice exception that was spelled out in Burnett, the court talks about two different things, observable changes in an employer's condition and medical condition that prevents the employee from communicating completely with the employer. And it's our position that we have elements of both of those in this situation and more than enough to allow this to go to a trier of fact on that factually laden.
All right, could you address counsel's point about the timeliness of the notification, please?
We believe that due to the nature of her condition during this two-week period, she did not know when she would be going back to work. And as soon as the doctor told her on the 20th that she could go back to work, she took that note in on that very day. So there was, from our view of this, immediate notification as soon as she understood. And that was after the Elevil had kicked in and she was able to sleep, she got control of herself, and she would be able to return to the workplace. I think my time is up, unless there are other questions.
Apparently not. Thank you, Ms. Kanoy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Gingold. The case will be taken under advisement.